This is the Alien UFO Podcast, Episode 5, and I'm your host, Simon Baum. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. And I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And this is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 25 minutes. And to get access to the extra 25 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And of course, you get the back catalogue. Obviously, as this is episode 5, there will only be 5 available at the moment, but the back catalogue will grow every week. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and the links are in the show notes. And please check out my other podcast. It is called The Past Lives Podcast. There are over 190 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week I'm talking to Marcus Louth about his book, From Deep Within the Archives of UFO Insight, History's Most Bizarre, Outlandish, and Controversial UFO and Alien Encounters. Marcus is a writer and researcher who has extensively researched multiple areas of the paranormal, strange locations, unsolved mysteries, UFOs and aliens, legends and folklore, conspiracy claims and much more for over 20 years. Since 2015, he has used his research to write extensively about these subjects professionally in the form of hundreds of articles across multiple platforms, most predominantly UFO Insight, Listversed, and Me Time for the Mind, as well as contributing regularly to the UFO Truth magazine. Hi, Marcus. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
No problem at all. Looking forward to chatting with you. No problem at all. Thank you.
Your book is called From Deep Within the Archives of UFO Insight, History's Most Bizarre, Outlandish and Controversial UFO and Alien Encounters. And it's just packed full of such fascinating information and so many great cases. But can I just ask, first of all, it says from the archives of UFO Insight. So what is UFO Insight?
Okay, well, UFO Insight, they're obviously a website that deal with UFOs, but also conspiracy and paranormal and crypto, you know, cryptozoology, should I say, and things of that nature. I've been writing for them since about 2016. I'm the acting editor-in-chief at this stage. And we've basically, you know, as the book suggests, we've scoured the internet, we've spent years researching old books, books that aren't even in print anymore, that we've, you know, that have been handed down to secondhand shops and things like that. Old fanzines, we've basically brought all those together with the aim of putting them in one place, which is UFO Insight. We've literally got hundreds and hundreds of cases that we've documented on there, that we've put our opinion on, you know, what they may or may not be. And so we took 60 of those and we decided to come up with this book. And they were purposes to tell, suggest the most outlandish ones, some of the most controversial and, you know, bizarre, basically. You know, you probably have to treat some of these like you do other ones, with a pinch of salt, you know. Because, you know, they may or may not be true. They may, some are more credible than others. But if we're going to research this sort of stuff, whether it's UFOs or it's paranormal or anything like that, then you need to look at all of them, you know, and try and stay in the middle, you know, pretty neutral and just say, you know, this is what's happened, this is what the claims are, and let the readers make up their own minds.
Yeah, that's great. Would you describe yourself then as like an open-minded skeptic?
Probably the other way. I'd say I hate the word believer because, you know, you want to know, you don't just want to believe in something, you know. I wouldn't say I'm skeptical. I'm probably more skeptical than many people would assume I am. But I'm certainly open-minded, and I think that has to go both ways. You know, you can't just believe what people tell you. You can't just believe accounts that you read. You know, through experience, you know, the more and more that you research this sort of stuff, and I've been looking into this, you know, for pushing 20 years, admittedly the first decade or so, just literally reading and getting my hands on as much research material as possible before I started thinking about putting it out on the internet. But you start to realise that some sources are more credible than others. You start to recognise patterns and details that show up a lot over many, many, many accounts. So, yeah, I think it's certainly important to be open-minded. I don't know if I go either way. I just want to really, you know, along with many, many other researchers over the course of many years, try to get to the heart of what is the UFO and alien question.
And so over the years of your research and your study, was there some things at the beginning that for you, they were just too far gone? You're just like, oh, no, that's just too crazy. I'm not going there. But after years of research, you start to think, well, hang on a second. There might be something real. There might be something actually going on with this stuff that I thought was too crazy.
Yeah, there's a few, and there's probably a few of those things that I probably do still think that's a bit outlandish, but there might be something to it. I'll come on to that in a minute, but this in itself is bizarre. But when I first started researching UFOs and aliens and paranormal, a few suggestions were that the reasons behind alien abduction was an alien hybridization program, you know, essentially mixing human DNA with alien DNA, which, you know, when you read that sort of stuff, you just think, you know, you need to take it with a huge pinch of salt. But the more I've researched these alien abduction claims specifically, and through the extensive research of people such as David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, who are both very serious-minded people, that suggestion comes up more and more and more. And as I say, Hopkins and Jacobs, essentially, that is what they say. This is what they believe, and their research leads them to conclude. So I would say that is the most outlandish thing that I've probably read, that over the course of the years that I've researched this, I kind of think, well, if alien abductions are real, you know, as preposterous as it might sound, that is a possible end goal for these abductions. They all involve medical procedures. A lot of the details in cases lean towards some kind of record keeping, targeted abductions, people who are repeatedly abducted over the course of the lifetime, specifically while they're in childbearing age. And, you know, this sort of stuff can sometimes go through generations, you know, the same family. So I would say that is something that I think, well, maybe there could be something to that. The other one I would say, and it's a little bit off topic and we'll not, you know, spend too much time on this, I would say, but the reptilian conspiracy, you know, I think all of us who have studied anything to do with UFOs and aliens, that gets thrown about and you read accounts of, you know, reptilians. Now, I kind of still think the idea of, you know, lizard men, if you like, wandering around like the old TV show V, is a little bit far-fetched. But when you study UFOs or anything that's a little bit on the fringes, you tend to find yourself drifting into other areas, whether it be paranormal or in this case history and alternative theories on history. And what I've found is throughout history and going back thousands of years, there are multiple references to serpent gods and serpent people and serpent lineage and things of that nature. So in terms of reptilians, I would say, while I'm still very sceptical of those things, I would say there could be something in it as far as a bloodline or some kind of ancient civilization that we don't know about that maybe were more reptilian-like. I mean, this is just speculation on my part, but I'd say those are the two things that stand out immediately anyway when you ask me that question.
I suppose there's this thing of witness verification. There's people all around the world, they all speak different languages, but they report like the hybrid children and reptilians. And so I agree with you, this thing with the reptilians is a bit too far for me as well. But if somebody in Brazil reports it and somebody in the USA reports it, somebody in Russia does, they don't know each other, but they're all describing the same thing. It does make you think, hang on, is there something here?
Yeah, and I think it's a good example of how multi-layered and complex just the subject of UFOs and aliens are, because as we've already kind of drifted into, you drift into other areas of research. You know, I mean, for example, let's say aliens are real and they are visiting the planet, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that is the case, you know, we have the image mainly of grey aliens. But as you say, there are many, many, many reports of people that say, you know, they had like reptilian-like skin, scaly skin, and they do describe reptilian. So, you know, it could be, it's almost like a clashing of worlds of mythology and accounts that are being reported today. And you could go as far as you want with this. I mean, you know, for example, again, sorry to off topic, but there's a theory called the psychic internet theory, which kind of fascinates me. I forget the guy's name who actually pushed this, and I apologize for that. But he was basically saying that what these things such as UFOs, aliens, anything paranormal, Bigfoot, for example, they could almost be like the power of the human mind manifesting these things, not as an hallucination as such, they're very real, but they're coming from the collective subconscious minds. He describes them as being connected like computers on the internet. So reptilians could also fall into that category, that people have some kind of knowledge of them. They go places expecting to see them, and there they are, and they're both hallucinations and real at the same time. Again, this tentacles that go in all directions. You can look back at ancient legends such as Ptah of ancient Egypt, who legends state that he imagined the world into being. So you've got a kind of connection there. But as I say, it's all speculation and it's all multi-layered. But the point that you made, that, yeah, people are describing the same things across many decades around the world. And a lot of this stuff was before the internet, so you didn't have access to information like you do now. And I think that alone is enough to warrant serious study of it, because it could be something very real, or it could tell us something of the human mind. It could tell us about our own reality. And I think that's why it's so fascinating as well.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about this, is that it is so complicated and mysterious. And it's like almost like we'll never know. I remember Whitley Strieber said, if these ETs, the visitors, as he calls them, they are not stranger than you imagine, they're stranger than you can imagine.
I'm familiar with the quote. And again, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, you know, I've been asked a few times, what do you think the definitive conclusion will be to this? And I agree with you. I don't think there actually ever will be one in any lifetime, you know, because as I say, we're not just talking of one specific thing. We're really, when we're speaking of these mysterious visitations, sightings, you know, when we go back to mythology from ancient times, well, what is mythology? You know, in hundreds of years' time, alien abduction cases will be the mythology of the future, if that makes sense. So I think we're really studying our own reality and our own perception of reality as much as we're studying UFOs or Bigfoot or ghosts or things like that.
So do you think we're any nearer understanding what's going on than we were, say, in the 40s and 50s?
I'd say in some ways, yes, because obviously we've got a wealth of accounts now, you know, that have been reported solidly, and we've documented those, and they're still available for the most part. I would imagine there's a wealth of accounts that aren't available that are sat somewhere either, you know, in a government vault or just forgotten about in a shed somewhere. And there'll be a wealth of accounts that people just will not have reported or spoken about. So I think in that respect, yes, we're a little bit further ahead. You've got multiple researchers, whether they collaborate directly or indirectly, just through reading each other's research, you start to build up a bigger picture. But I think as we've just said, there's so much there. It's almost like the more answers you come up with or think you can come up with, the more questions will spring. And so it sounds a little bit ambiguous, but yes and no, basically, is what I would say to that.
And it also seems like it starts interconnecting with other things. You know, when you hear people who see a UFO in the forest and they say, well, I saw a Bigfoot about that time as well.
Yeah, now this is the one thing that I kind of harp on about a lot, and it really fascinates me. It's probably one of the things that not solely drew me in, but kind of maintained my interest, is that, as you say, things do connect. You said it yourself, in UFO hotspots, you will usually, or not usually, but often, you will get a lot of Bigfoot sightings. Bigfoot sightings and UFO sightings go together, and you know, there has to be a reason for that. Now, you know, not to spend too much time on it, but Are Bigfoot aliens? Are these hotspots places where there might be portals and gateways to all manner of things that come from places that, you know, other realms of existence or dimensions or something like that? And, you know, other things that connect to, like, if you look at alien abduction cases, there's so many details that come up in those accounts, which you would expect to find in paranormal activity, such as, you know, electrical devices failing, people seeing shadow people at the corner of their eyes, strange bumps, doors opening. So it does make you wonder if, you know, it might be a little bit simplistic to say, well, ghosts are aliens, aliens are ghosts. I don't necessarily think it's that clean cut, but I think there's a hell of a bleed between what people would perceive as unrelated fields of interest. And there's a few researchers, you know, Paulino is one, and there's a number of others that have kind of hinted heavily towards, you know, that all these things are connected. If we understand one of them, we'll start to understand the rest. But I mean, ultimately, yeah, I mean, it's so layered and multifaceted. It's almost too much for one researcher to kind of, you know, get to the bottom of. But between all of us over decades, I'm sure we will get there. I'll get closer to where we think we should be with it.
So I have another podcast. It's called The Past Lives Podcast, a little plug there. And I talk to a lot of people that research near-death experiences and have had near-death experiences. And we've noticed that the after effects of somebody who's claimed to have been abducted by aliens are the same. Are the things that you were talking about, electrical things, catching the shadow people, kind of psychic flashes, and also amazing synchronicities. And so it's interesting that people who've had a near-death experience have those same after effects.
Yeah, I mean, and there's probably a number of possibilities. You know, if we're talking about near death, then obviously you're talking to the point where your brain, although it's obviously still functional, you wouldn't be able to come back, but it's literally on it. I mean, I'm no medical expert, but it's on his last legs, you know, to put it bluntly. And so then then we have to start questioning, well, if people are literally and medically at death's door, literally, and then they come back and they have all these memories, feelings, you know, things happening, and they're kind of mirrored in alien abduction cases, then, you know, we might have to ask, well, are alien abduction cases some kind of near-death experience and they're kind of reported as memories? Now, again, I mean, that's simplistic. I'm just pulling this stuff out of the air, you know, but, I mean, that is something that might want to be considered. But it's also interesting that there's loads of alien, well, not loads, but there's many alien abduction accounts which suggest that the person is almost abducted and it's an out-of-body experience. They remain where they are physically, but they themselves are on board an alien spacecraft or a base or wherever. And so there could be a connection there. But, yeah, you're right. It's interesting that these areas that we don't fully understand, that there are, you know, tentative connections. And again, I think if we understand one, it'll shine a light on other areas and we'll start to understand others.
I had a guest on who was a psychic on this other podcast, and she was saying that one night she woke up, found herself standing next to her bed, and there were four of these greys at the foot of her bed. And, you know, obviously she freaked out just finding herself standing there, and she looked back at the bed and her body was still in the bed. And then she said it was like that. She was back in her body and she quickly sat up and the ETs weren't there. So it was almost like the ETs were in this, I don't know what you call it, like astral plane that she saw when she was out of her body.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting account. I mean, you know, skeptics will instantly say, well, that's something like sleep paralysis or those moments where you're waking and dreaming, and it could very well be. What I would say there is what's interesting is if you read some accounts of astral projection, especially people who claim to be able to do it, you know, at will or force themselves to leave their body, a lot of them will speak of like entities and forces that are looking to almost make it back to their body before they do, which, you know, it sounds preposterous to people who have no experience of astral projection or things of that nature. But again, it's that crossover again, you know, are aliens, some people already have made that assertion that aliens and demonic forces, for want of a better phrase, are one and the same. So, you know, say if this account was true, for example, you know, she really did leave her body and she really did wake up. it could be a scenario such as that. But yeah, I mean, we all think of alien abduction as being a physical experience, and maybe some of them are. But as I say, there are a lot of cases that suggest that it's an out of body experience as much as anything else.
So, have you had experiences? Have you seen UFOs?
I've seen a strange light. I mean, I've not seen anything up close. I've certainly not experienced alien abduction. I have seen a strange light. That basically, me and my son, we went out to the yard. We were looking. It was like there was a meteor shower that evening, so we were just idly looking for meteors. And what we thought was a star just suddenly zipped to one side of the sky and stopped a couple of seconds and zipped. You know, when we're talking about high in the sky, so they zipped for God knows how many miles elsewhere, and then they zipped off and was gone. And we both just looked at each other and said, "Did you see that?" And yeah, we saw that. And then we just came inside, you know. So it wasn't dramatic. It could have been, you know, something like an alien craft. It certainly wasn't something normal. It wasn't a star. It wasn't a satellite or anything. It certainly wasn't a meteor. What it might have been, who knows? But yeah, that's probably the closest I've been to seeing what you would say is a UFO. But it was certainly something very strange.
Yeah, it's interesting, that description of how it moved is what we hear, isn't it? That they move so fast, but then they can stop in an instant.
And that's it. I mean, I think that's what we just happened to be, because we were looking upwards anyway, you kind of just suddenly notice this star moving and stop. You know, and I've been at first, it's a little bit exhilarating. That's why I felt, wow, this is really something strange. And then in a few seconds, it zipped off. And there's almost just a taking it in your stride sort of, you know, thinking, well, yeah, that was something strange. Now, don't get me wrong, I think if you saw something up close, and certainly if you had, you know, what you would perceive as interaction with alien entities, it'd be a lot more dramatic and a lot more, you know, there'd be a lot more emotion involved. But yeah, I mean, people are describing those kinds of things, and they have been doing for years. I mean, a lot of the initial UFO cases in the start of what, you know, people call the modern UFO era from the late 40s are basically lights in the skies that start moving in a zigzag fashion, you know, and basically performing maneuvers which no aircraft even today can achieve. So, yeah, it was certainly something strange. It was what it was. As I say, it's unexplained, and I'll probably never know what it was.
It's interesting you say that thing where it's like you saw it and then you just kind of got on with your life. I've read about, and it's something that happened to me in a way. My first episode of this podcast, I talked about the two sightings I've had. Mm. And one of them was really close up. It was an object that was just a few feet above the trees. It didn't move an inch the whole time. And it was very close to me and completely silent. And I saw it from my car, and I slowed down to like 5 miles an hour, and I was staring up at it from my windscreen. And then I just speeded up and drove off.
Yeah.
And I think back of it and think, well, you know, I'm so into UFOs. Why didn't I stop? And it's almost as if there's this thing where the ETs would affect people to kind of turn off their interest.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like some kind of telepathic influence.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it works lots of ways. Lots of people, there's lots of accounts where people say they watch it for so long and then they go. And you mean, you know, if you look at, say, comments on videos, now again, videos that are released onto the internet, you've got to come in Pinterest, but some of them are really quite intriguing. And people do say, you know, why did you stop filming? Why did you go? And that could very well be the case. I mean, there's also cases the other way around where, you know, one of them is, we might speak about later, is where people are kind of called to these places where UFOs are going to appear. They go to destinations and they have no idea why they're going there. They just have an impulse to go. And, you know, there's either a reason for that, so it's targeted on what we will assume is alien, on the alien's part, or it's something that, some energy that they just tap into. But yeah, I mean, the idea of telepathic communication, for example, that's an interesting detail in itself. It's been around in alien abduction and alien encounter cases since the very beginning of the modern UFO era, when people really weren't talking about telepathic communication. So, I think there is something to that. And, you know, some people specifically say that aliens will only reveal themselves, if you like, to who they want to reveal themselves to. Now, again, how credible those kind of assertions are, who knows, but it is interesting. And yeah, as you say, I would imagine that a lot of people, unless you're in a situation where you feel threatened, probably will take it in the stride and then just kind of move on.
And there's also that thing of, is it screen memories, where you might see an animal, but it's like it's an ET and they're putting that image into your mind. I think Mike Cleland did a lot with this with owls and his books.
Yeah, I mean, this is another interesting aspect of it all, because, you know, I forget the author and I apologise, but there was an account I was reading where a family was abducted, basically, you know, from the home, lived out in the country in America. And the memories they had of the previous night were stood in front of like a mobile home. And they were contemplating whether they were going to buy this mobile home. And when they kind of were hypnotically regressed, it was clear to them that the mobile home was a spaceship. And they weren't, they weren't contemplating or chatting or anything. They were undergoing an alien abduction. Now, an interesting twist on that, that I find intriguing, is if you go and look at a lot of the CIA experiments and alleged experiments concerning things such as MKUltra and mind control and using, you know, hallucinatory drugs and things like that, the account in 57, I think it's of Louis Boas, who claimed he was abducted by an alien, and he even went on to say that he can conceive a child with this female alien entity. Some researchers and some whistleblowers have suggested that that wasn't an alien abduction case at all. What he thought was a flying saucer was only a military helicopter, but he had been partly mind-controlled, and with the use of drugs, they had made him perceive it as a flying saucer. And they even went as far as to say that the female alien was a local prostitute. And it was all to see how far they could take this, how far they could make somebody believe that that had happened. Now, this whistleblower wasn't saying that's the case in every single case of alien abduction, but he was suggesting that it was in this one. What's also interesting there is that if you look at places like Dulce in New Mexico, some researchers have suggested that they're doing the very same thing. There are secret underground experiments going on, but they're being conducted under the guise of alien abduction, because it's so preposterous that people will just dismiss this stuff, and these dark government departments, if indeed they do exist, can operate, you know, without hassle, basically. So, yeah, the screen memory is an interesting thing. And just as a little offshoot on that, there's a lot of alien abduction cases where people speak of being given clear liquid to drink, not water, but some kind of strange clear liquid, which is, they say, distorts their memories and puts false memories in place and things of that nature. So, again, just that one little aspect of the UFO encounters, you can take in loads of different areas, and there's so much to explore, and each is, as credible as the next, really. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's another interesting aspect of it all.
Yeah, yeah. I talked to Deborah Jordan Corbell. She was one of the sisters that was in the Bud Hopkins book, Intruders.
Right, yeah.
She was a guest on the podcast, and she did say that the one night she was in a cabin, I think, in the woods, and a bunch of men came in and took her away. And she woke up at one point, and she was like on a hospital bed, and there was a man leaning over, and he said something like, "Don't worry, this won't hurt." And he injected her. And then he said, "Why am I even talking to you? You're not going to remember this."
Again, there's so many cases of alien, and I know the account, I've read Intruders, it's a great book, but there's so many cases where there's a human presence to these alien abductions, normally a military presence. So again, we've got a few things to consider. Are alien abductions just secret military operations? I mean, that's a bit bizarre for most people to even begin to believe. Are these humans that are present actually aliens, and we're made to perceive them as humans, or is there a collaboration? You know, some people genuinely believe that there's some kind of secret deal that the American administration in the 50s made for technology, and in return they would give these aliens access to the human population. Now, again, most people dismiss such notions, and they are perhaps right to, but yeah, it is interesting that in many, many cases of alien abduction, people speak about there being humans present in the room and these things are taking place.
Yeah, and I think we need to get onto your book, because I want to talk about your book, but just one small thing there is, when I talked to Whitley Strieber, he was saying sometimes the same time the ETs were there, the dead would show up as well. People would see dead relatives, and it's such a weird connection there. But we'll get on to your book now. One of the things you say is in the book is that this is but a tiny amount of the mountain of reports and accounts that are available. So did it take you a long time to go through them and think, oh man, I need to put everything in this book, and it was difficult to pull out the ones you did put in?
No, not really. I mean, because we've been building, I mean, I've been reading about this stuff as far back as I can remember. I've always had an interest in this sort of stuff anyway. So, you know, a lot of that reading time and then putting these things out as articles is research in itself. I mean, as I say, we've got hundreds and hundreds of articles, and we've probably covered thousands of UFO accounts in there. And, you know, and I do a similar thing on my other website, Me Time for the Mind, which looks at similar content. So we'll always be building on that anyway. The idea is that UFO Insight, for example, specifically, it will be, as well as an entertaining website for good reads, it will be a research tool. You know, you can just put into the search bar whatever case, and hopefully we'll have something on it. And we've got plans to do further books, some similar to this, some a bit more in-depth, looking at maybe something specific. And, you know, we're currently collecting UFO reports from readers that have not been in the public arena, and no doubt they will find their way into a manuscript. So when we put this book together, it was just a case of, let's quickly go through what we've already got, where we already are as UFO Insight. Me, and I say we because there is a guy who works behind the scenes who does all the behind-the-scenes stuff, basically. And we just picked the 60 most intriguing, but, you know, they had to have something a little bit different about them, that they were just a little bit, whether it's there was a cover-up or whether they're a bit bizarre or whether they're even a bit unbelievable. And the sort of thing that you would find only in the far reaches of the internet, generally speaking. And then we just put that in a manuscript and you know, we'll let that go. But yeah, we've got plans for all other books anyway. So no, it wasn't hard because we know we're going to cover much more content as the months and the years go on.
So if we just go over the basic makeup of the book, you've got four sections there. One's sightings, yeah. One's called truly bizarre, one's called abduction, and one of them's called conspiracy, conspiracy, conspiracy. So yeah. I just wanted to ask, why did you call it that with the three words?
Those accounts that are in that section there are all accounts that you would associate with conspiracy. For example, you know, the Falcon and Condor claims, you know, was that disinformation? There's the Lead Masks case, which, you know, when you delve into that, it almost hints that there's a CIA connection, you know, to the death of the two young men there. The Soviet pilot that officially doesn't exist, but plenty of people said he did. He had strange encounters. So they're all really revolved around, there's loads of stuff on secret alleged government projects as well. So, you know, I don't think you can study UFOs and aliens without touching at least on certain aspects of the conspiracy world. So that's what we try to do with that section.
So can we go over the first case in the book, which is the 1956 Ryan Neff UFO sighting? So what happened there?
Yeah, well, this one, it's credible for a couple of reasons, not least that the two main witnesses were both professional pilots with, you know, ample flying time under the belts. It was in April 1956, and it was an American Airlines passenger plane that was traveling between New York and Buffalo. It was Captain Raymond Ryan and William Neff were the pilots. Now, the incident was also witnessed by a stewardess who happened to be in the cockpit at the time. Now, what they saw was a bright light, like we've just been speaking about, you know, in the distance, but clear, and it was hovering. And as they were watching this, it suddenly accelerated to what they estimated to be around 900 miles per hour. And it was glowing a brighter orange colour as it moved. Now, that's a nice detail there because a lot of UFO reports over the years state that the colour of the UFO is indicative of whether it's moving and how fast it's moving. That's what some people suggest. It is claimed when Ryan initially spoke to the Buffalo Evening News that he was ordered to pursue the object until military jets arrived. Now, he initially claimed that he did try and do this, but he disappeared over the border towards Lake Ontario, which, again, as a side note, there's, I'm sure you're aware of this yourself, more often than not, UFO sightings are reported on or over or near water. And some of the lakes in the North American continent are, you know, hotspots for UFO sightings. So after this was reported, basically there were suggestions of cover-up, and you know, the magazine Flying Saucer Review basically said as much. Ryan retracted everything he said. He said he wasn't ordered to pursue the objects, and you know, essentially just washed his hands of it. American Airlines denied anything ever happened. So even back then in the 1950s, when you know, we had Blue Book, which was allegedly looking into these things, there was seemingly attempts to suppress the incident. What's interesting is the Buffalo Evening News have never wavered from their version of events. And you would think if Ryan was legitimate in retracting his claims, he would have taken some kind of legal action against the paper. So, you know, it's possible American Airlines just didn't want the publicity. If passengers thought they were tracing UFOs, and obviously that's putting their life in danger. But I would suggest it's a very credible sighting. And, you know, this occurred sandwiched between waves of UFO reports, like in 52, 54, and 57. So there was certainly something in the skies during, obviously in every decade, but certainly in the 1950s. So, yeah, I think it's a credible sighting, and the allegations of at least a suppression of the account are probably very accurate.
I think when they saw it and they were contacting the Air Force, and after a while they got radar confirmation, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, this was it, but this was all denied. I mean, after the fact, you know, there was something there. As I said, there were three separate witnesses, whether any of the passengers saw anything or not, or people on the ground. But the military was certainly aware of it. Now, the question I would say is whether the military put pressure on American Airlines to have the pilots retract the statements and issue a denial, or whether American Airlines took it on themselves to do that. I would suggest it's probably the former. Although, you know, at the time, it certainly wouldn't have hurt American Airlines to put some distance between themselves and you know, what could have potentially be a collision in midair.
It's almost a conspiracy in itself, isn't it? And it's so difficult to pick it apart.
Yeah.
So if we move on to the next case that I wanted to talk about, the disturbing encounter of Mrs. Everett Stewart. That's another one with multiple witnesses.
Yeah, this is another strange one as well, because not only is it a UFO sighting, but there are suggestions of not alien abduction, but certainly some kind of bizarre contact. It happened in October 66, and I believe it was in Cincinnati. Now, she claimed that she was basically in the middle of a telephone conversation with her daughter, and she suddenly smelled this very strong odor. Now, she didn't say what it was, but what is interesting there is that multiple UFO cases, close encounter cases and cases of aliens, a lot of the witnesses speak of a sulfur odor, very overpowering and unpleasant. What's also interesting is a lot of paranormal cases, stuff to do with ghosts and things of that nature, they also report the same odour. So there's another little connection there. Now, basically, she had a feeling she was being watched all of a sudden. So she wrapped up the conversation, she went to the bedroom window, and outside was, you know, an oval-shaped UFO. She said an oval-shaped object, and it had red, green, and white flashing lights. Now, her husband was asleep on the bed, she woke him up, and he witnessed this also. A little side note here is the object that she's describing. Several months earlier in March and April, there were a wave of sightings of exactly the same object, multiple sightings of this object with red, white and green flashing lights in Michigan and then in Massachusetts. So it's interesting that this shows up again and not too far away in Ohio. Now, she called her daughter at this point. The UFO zipped away and it came back and it hovered in front of the house and stayed there for about 10 minutes. And she called her daughter so she could see it. It eventually moved away and a couple of the members of the family went to pursue it. Janet, meanwhile, stayed at home, if I believe, and then she came outside. She could see the UFO in the distance and then it zipped towards her. Now, she described that moment as being fantastic and euphoric. By contrast, Mrs. Stewart, who felt positively ill, sick and dizzy from the encounter, fell asleep on a bed, and she claimed that while she was asleep or during that time, a bright light flashed into her room, like an orb appeared, and there were five basically grey aliens within this orb, and they made telepathic communication with her and disappeared. This is a sighting where we've got multiple witnesses. It's of a craft that's been seen before that year in that vicinity of the United States. And it would appear that there is an alien connection if we were to believe Mrs. Stewart's account. And there's no reason not to believe the account. She is, by all from what I can gather in the research I've done, a very credible witness. She didn't seek any monetary, compensation, and didn't try to make any money out of it or anything of that nature. Her name is a pseudonym anyway. It's not her, even a real name. So that all goes in her favor. But yeah, it's another account, which is one of those which, because its details resonates with other accounts on record, it should be treated relatively seriously.
And it's so bizarre, this idea of this luminous sphere that was in the bedroom with these five heads in it. And I think her description was very similar to the Greys.
Yeah, that's right. That's how she described them, you know, larger heads, big almond eyes, which is, you know, how many people who have close encounters describe these entities. So, you know, I suppose we have to ask, is this some kind of like projection? It's, you know, like a hologram from the craft. Were they really there in one form or another? And I suppose you have to ask, although there's no suggestion of it, but, you know, did it some kind of abduction take place? And that was just the last memories she had. But yeah, it definitely puts it connects the grey aliens to UFO sightings again.
And, you know, skeptics might say that, you know, there was this smell around and it was actually some sort of natural hallucinogen from somewhere, I don't know, and that's what caused them to see it. But I believe they called the police and the police said that this was their 45th call that night.
That's right, yeah. I think it was Mrs. Stewart, who called the police. And yeah, they said that I'd talked to reports that evening of something strange in the sky. So, you know, if it was just one person, even if she had to call the police, you might be able to argue that, you know, there was some kind of toxic gas in the air. But as I say, the fact that shows, and it's a detail that shows up in accounts, almost as a throwaway detail. Oh, yeah, and, not something that people harp on about, and there was this strong smell of sulfur. Now, she didn't specifically say this, but, you know, through my research, I would suggest that is what she was describing. And because that's mentioned so many times, and as you say, you know, the police had X amount of reports. Her daughter saw it. I think her husband saw it. Obviously, Mrs. Stewart's husband saw it. So, and they were in different houses, remember, Mrs. Stewart and Janet. So, again, I think the hallucination one wouldn't really hold water if people were to use that. It is a possibility. But the fact that people mention that detail is, again, like a notch in the credibility column for me personally.
And it's another case in the book with multiple witnesses, which is, it's always good to have multiple witnesses, isn't it? Because it's verification. So how many of the cases in the book would you say have multiple witnesses?
I mean, I wouldn't know as a count off the top of my head, but there's, I were certainly in double figures. I mean, we look at 60 main accounts, and even with those, we look at like some corroborating accounts, you know, where there might have been a similar sighting, say, several weeks later in a similar area. But yeah, there's lots of cases in the book where there are more than one witness. And as you say, you know, it's perhaps easy to dismiss, even nicely, somebody who's seen something on their own as, oh, well, maybe it was just mistaken, or maybe they had some kind of hallucination. When there's more than one witness, and when those witnesses especially are spread over different locations, then obviously that's much harder to do. And I think at that stage, you're almost better off taking what is said at face value and going with what's been offered. That's not to say that you should believe it outright, but, you know, you certainly can't dismiss it as an hallucination at that stage.
Yeah, and I suppose if somebody comes forward, they're just by themselves and it's a single witness report, and they talk about things that lots of other people have said, in some way that can be a verification.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think even UFO researchers, and I think it's a little unfair, really, but I mean, I can understand why they do it. But, you know, they will ask, one of the first things they'll ask is, does this person have an interest in UFOs? Could they have read these details beforehand? And even subconsciously, you know, just been mentioning things of that nature. But, yeah, I think that's perhaps even easier to put towards somebody now in the days of the internet. But what I would say is it's not just the details that match, whether it be, you know, descriptions of grey aliens or the shape of this alleged spacecraft. it's really trivial details. For example, one of the ones that always gets me is what people talk about, no source lighting. People who claim they've been inside these alien crafts, they mention that the walls, it's well illuminated, but it's almost like it's illuminated from within the walls, and they can't see any sort, you know, there's no light bulb, there's no light strip. It's just like the light is coming from the walls. That's a bizarre detail. And admittedly, people could read that sort of stuff, but these are things being mentioned before the age of the internet and before like widespread publications of books on the subject. So it's little details like that. Surprisingly enough, a lot of people speak about there being a presence of stone and rock and almost like a biblical feel to the inside of these crafts. Again, it's a detail that you would imagine if people are pulling details out of thin air and trying to make them sound spaceshipy, for want of a better phrase, a better word. They would be saying things of like steel and, you know, metallic tables, but they're speaking of things like stone, strange stone tables and stone chairs. So to me, it's not just details that match. It's some of the finer, throwaway, trivial details that are almost given as an afterthought, but resonate and make you think, yeah, that's something that comes up a lot.
I heard an interview with a guy called Joe Montaldo, who does a lot of research with these alien abductions, and he was saying that there are certain things that he hears often that he never talks about. So it's one of those things that if he does hear it, he thinks, this is likely to be more genuine because there's no way they would have heard of this.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the wisdom in doing that, and I think it's a good move. I think, I guess at some point he would publish his research. So at some point those details will possibly fall into the public arena. The only thing with that is, I suppose, that research then starts with him. The one thing I like about when I say sharing research, I don't mean like sharing notes before they're made available to the public, obviously. But, you know, one thing about being able to read other people's research and ideas is that sometimes you'll read something and you'll, through that information, that piece of information, connect two bits of information that you were struggling with, and that's how things grow. But I can certainly see the logic and the sense in doing that. I think it's probably, like I say, harder to do that now in the age of the internet, where, you know, someone can get in front of the computer, tap away, and then literally seconds later it's all around the world. So that's just one of the pitfalls of UFO and alien research, really, that you are going to deal with people that have manufactured incidents, whether they've done that purposely for monetary gain, or whether they've done it subconsciously, or whether it's a cry for help or whatever. And I think the only way around that is you just have to be aware, and you have to make up your own mind individually in each case. You know, ultimately, most researchers, I wouldn't say they tend to know when something is a hoax or not, but you certainly get inklings. So yeah, it's just one of those things, I think, that you have to deal with, you know.
So if we move on to the next section of the book, it's called Abduction. And can we talk about, is it the Latomian Aino account?
Yeah, now that's the guy, that's the journalist who first put this account into print in a Finnish newspaper in 1978. And this is a really intriguing one. And again, there's reasons to believe this is credible. Now, it's claimed that a lady named Annie Latu, who lived in Finland, I believe in the north of the country, I could be wrong on that, sometime between January and April 1917, she went missing basically for several days. Nobody knew where she were. When she returned, she claimed that an object that she described as looking like a washing basin came out of the sky. Now, a wash basin in Finland at that time was essentially like a very large plate, and you might describe it as a saucer. So right there, before the phrase flying saucer, before anybody had any inkling of UFOs and what they might look like, there's a description that matches with the descriptions of UFOs that came 30 years later. So that's interesting. She claimed that a ladder appeared from the side of the craft, and that's another detail which, you know, comes up a lot in future alien abduction incidents. And she described creatures as being like little devils that basically, against her will, took her inside the craft. And she went on to say that, you know, she went above the world and in between the stars. So, you know, she's essentially describing what we would say space travel. Going back to that point I made a few moments ago about no source lighting, she claimed that she went into a room where the light shined from the inside. Now, again, that's a detail. If we're assuming that she's credible, there's no way she would have known that. I mean, those details, people weren't putting those connections together until probably the 80s, 90s, when alien abduction accounts were rife. So, and then she also went on to say that the creatures, they spoke to her, but she didn't understand how, and she didn't understand how she understood them. Again, she didn't say as much, but to me, she's describing telepathic communication. Most people in the village dismissed the claims and said she was likely mad or she hallucinated or something of that nature. A UFO investigator in the 1970s, now we went, you know, researching this case, and he tracked down a witness who he named Mrs. N.N., obviously not her real name, but she said when she was a child, her mother was a friend of Annie's, and she recalled conversations of this incident. And so what we know is, if we believe Mrs. N.N., and again, there's no reason not to, that this Annie Latour did exist. She did go missing. She was reported as being a widow, but she claimed, Mrs. N.N., that she was actually married, but her husband was basically never there. And that's that one. And so if that's a legitimate, credible case of alien abduction, this is something that happened 30 years before even the Roswell crash, and over 40 years before what most people describe as certainly the first case to get a lot of publicity, the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. So then we have to ask, well, how long has this been going on for? Has it been going on long before the Roswell incident? And does it go back hundreds of years? It's one of those where I think, because it poses that question, it's an important case to keep on record.
And there is a kind of sceptical criticism that because this idea of alien abduction and greys is in popular culture and on TV and in movies, that people might hoax it. And like you said, they might not be aware they're hoaxing it because it's all around us and it's on the internet. But that lady in 1917, she wouldn't have known anything about alien abductions and that everything she described.
No, not at all, exactly. I mean, from all accounts, to put it bluntly, she lived like a simple life in a small village. You can imagine life in 1917, in a small village. So, yeah, it certainly wasn't it wasn't all around us. I suppose the only hole there is you might accuse the journalist who pulled the incident into the public arena in the 70s. You might say, okay, well, maybe they were influenced and they, but then you kind of, you're stopping short of accusing them of manufacturing it, which, without evidence, you need to be very careful of. And as I say, even in the 70s, although alien abduction cases were happening, they weren't widely reported on really until we got to the mid 80s, early 90s, when it was really rife with a lot of the Hollywood movies and Strieber's book Communion and stuff like that. So, if we say that the article in the newspaper in 78 was a legitimate account based on what was known, then yeah, it's an extremely interesting case. And the stuff that she's speaking about, whether it's the saucer shape of the craft, the little devils, which we would, if you look at what you think a grey alien is, you could imagine why somebody from 1917 would describe them as that. This is one that happened so far back. Whether we'd ever get to the bottom of this and whether we could know for sure whether it was credible or not, it's unknown, but it's certainly worth keeping on record because you can then compare that to many other accounts across the ages.
So the next case I wanted to talk about was the 1951 Salzburg alien abduction incident. That was a weird one.
This one you probably do have to take with a pinch of salt, and we'll go on to why. It's based on an article which appeared in 1957 in a British Columbia newspaper, and it's an unnamed American soldier who said he was based in Salzburg in May 1951. Now, he claimed he was walking home after being on duty one evening, and he saw what he thought was just a person walking towards him. He said he heard a click, and then all of a sudden he couldn't move. He was paralyzed. Now, this is an interesting detail. I have to say, just treat it with a pinch of salt, but this is an interesting detail because, bear in mind, he was telling this story in 1957. Instances of people being paralysed really began to enter the public arena as the 60s, 70s, and particularly 80s went on, as you would imagine with the increase of alien abduction claims. So the fact that he's mentioning that is quite interesting. Strangely, he would also say that it was fitted with some kind of strange device, which, when it was controlled by this humanoid, he was almost forced to move wherever he was, like a remote control. So he was guided towards what was essentially a spaceship. From there, though, he speaks about going into space. He does mention transparent walls of the spacecraft, which is another little interesting detail, which does show up in future accounts long before 1957. He claimed he landed on a planet which had red grass, and he would ultimately say it was Mars. Now, whether he was saying, I know it was Mars, or he assumed it was Mars, well, that's up for debate. The sticking point here is that this alien being apparently left the ship for no longer than a few minutes, came back and took him straight back to Earth, and then just let him go. So we're asking, well, what was the point of this abduction? You know, to the best of our knowledge, unless the witnesses just forgot it, there was no kind of wisdom imparted. There seemed to be no experiments undertaken. Unless just transporting somebody across space was the experiment. So, yeah, it's an interesting account. There's a few good details in there that do resonate with other accounts that happened years later, which you would imagine the witness really couldn't have known about. But it's just a bit strange, and there doesn't seem to be any point to it.
It seems like they went to another planet, came back, no communication from the abductor.
That's it. I mean, so there's three possibilities here, or possibly four. I suppose one, it could be an outright manufactured case, maybe for someone looking for financial reward. But I suppose the fact that he kept his anonymity maybe dismisses that. Maybe he was attacked and he imagined everything else, and in his mind it was very real. Now, if we assume he was taken on board the ship, then, as I say, there's two possibilities that I can think of straight away here. Is maybe just that transportation of a human being across vast reaches of space that quickly was in itself the experiment. And the other possibility is that experiments were conducted during that journey and they were simply wiped from his memory and he doesn't recall them. So, again, it's a case you have to take with a pinch of salt. There's some nice details in it. But there are a lot of questions that come up as a result of examining it.
So the book is called From Deep Within the Archives of UFO Insight, History's Most Bizarre, Outlandish and Controversial UFO and Alien Encounters. And that's on Amazon, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. You can get that on Amazon. You can go to the books page on UFO Insight or Me Time for the Mind and you can purchase it there. And obviously you'll find links on all our social media as well. But yeah, that's available. So hopefully we'll have a hardback edition of that soon. And we do have plans to release, more publications this year with a bit of luck.
And the website is ufoinsight.com.
That's correct, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast. It's been fascinating talking to you.
No, it's been brilliant. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for asking me. That's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Marcus Louth about his book, From Deep Within the Archives of UFO Insight, History's Most Bizarre, Outlandish and Controversial UFO and Alien Encounters. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. This is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 25 minutes. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It is called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 190 episodes, and it's where I look into evidence of the afterlife. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word, and on Twitter, I am at Simon G. Bowne. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.